a pleasure to come to Perimeter.
I should say the introduction sort of was too nice to me, because actually 5 years was only 5 years ago was only when I joined the reverse Shannon paper, and it actually was solved about 3 years before then. But this work should be published really within the next half decade tops. Okay, so by the way, are these lights on the board? Should they? Are they better on than off? Okay. Well, if you can see, okay, that's then. Okay, so I'm going to talk about entanglement and sort of an alternate view of entanglement, and the simplest kind of entanglement, the kind of entanglement between two people where it's just a pure state, a pure entangled state. Nothing mixed, no reference frames, just, you know, pure bipartite entanglement. So you have a state psi, that should be a sum over I and j of the superposition of states on Alice and Bob's side. And in the familiar model, we assume that quantum things are easy and classical communication, quantum things are expensive and classical computing is cheap. This is a reasonable assumption. So we assume that local operations we can do easily. This is maybe less reasonable, but classical communication certainly is much cheaper than anything to do with quantum. And so if we make these assumptions, then the picture of entanglement is very nice and tractable. So, and it's so nice and tractable that it's even a model for other kinds of resource theories. So so we get a nice ending to the story. First, local unitaries already dramatically simplify things. So if Alice and Bob can do arbitrary local unitaries, then their state can always be written in this this sort of diagonal form, where it's a superposition of orthogonal thing on Alice's side, tensor orthogonal thing on Bob's side. And the coefficients, these lambda i's, are the Schmidt coefficients. And they have a monotonicity property under this class of transformations, that if you have any LOCC transformation, will always the outcome will always majorize the input. And in fact, this is an if and only if. It completely describes what you can do with LOCC. And if we have many copies of a state, then things are even simpler. With many copies, then we can turn any state into many copies of the standard Bell pair, the EPR pair, and vice versa. We can turn many copies of Bell pairs into many copies of any other states. So in this world, we have a very simple asymptotic theory. Everything is just described by its amount of entropy of entanglement, which is the von Neumann entropy of the reduced state. And even on a single shot basis, we can exactly characterize when it's possible to turn one state into another state. And even refinements of this are possible. For example, if we can't do the transformation, we can still describe the maximum probability with which it's possible, and so on. So in this picture, as entanglement is a resource when classical communication is free, it's very well characterized. However, just changing this assumption that we can do classical communication for free, I would argue, changes everything about the resource picture. And for a while, people have tried to extend it in various ways, thinking about it, including me, as still a resource, but as one whose transformations are a little bit more constrained. But today, I want to propose a slightly different metaphor for thinking about entanglement. I want to think about entanglement as something that's constrained by superselection, similar to other actually invariant quantities. So by superselection, I mean that the quantum state space is divided up according to some observable. Think of total particle number here. So if you had a system where, let's say, bosons were conserved and there were two bosonic modes, then there'd be one dimension corresponding to having zero bosons, two dimensions corresponding to having one boson, three dimensions corresponding to having two bosons, and then off the bottom of the board, more dimensions. So the state space has this sort of partition, and anything we do to it has to respect this partition. So if you have a unitary matrix that operates on it, or a measurement, whatever, then it should have this block structure where it respects the partition corresponding to superselection. So you can't create a superposition of 0 and 1 electrons, for example. You can create a mixture of the two. So if you have an electron in a superposition of different places and you just look at one position, it may look like a mixture. But a superposition of different numbers of electrons is not allowed. OK, so I want to think about entanglement this way, which may seem a little bit daft, but here's the idea. The idea is that let's just allow Alice and Bob local unitaries for now. So the most restrictive model. In this model, their Schmidt coefficients always remain exactly the same. So it's like saying that the singular values of a matrix always stay the same when you multiply it on the left or right by unitaries. So in a certain sense, the amount of entanglement is exactly conserved under this. So if we can think of a state as being a superposition of different numbers of EPR pairs, so here P sub k is, think of it as some probability distribution over k, the number of EPR pairs. This k is a label that tells you how many EPR pairs you have. And then this final register actually carries all of the EPR pairs. So think of this as roughly as a superposition of different amounts of entanglement, which is a slightly counterintuitive thing to think of, but it's because, of course, the superposition itself carries some entanglement. But in an approximate sense, it's not so far off, because the superposition carries much less entanglement than this register. If we think of it this way, then local unitaries cannot dramatically change the number of this distribution P sub k. You can think of these as different sectors within which you can rotate, but you can't do things that will mix the different sectors. Now, this isn't quite true. This is not like electrons where it's physically impossible to do it. Here, different numbers of EPR pairs are only approximately orthogonal. So I'm abusing notation a little bit here. And when I say k copies and l copies, you should really think of these as being padded with additional qubits in the zero state. But still, a state which is equivalent locally to k EPR pairs and to l EPR pairs, these states are pretty far apart, but they're not exactly orthogonal. So it's not a strict superselection rule. And also, this decomposition is not, in general, possible. However, something pretty close to it is possible. So states may actually look pretty far from anything of this form. But if instead of talking about variable numbers of EPR pairs, we can think of k EPR pairs as just being a maximally entangled state of dimension 2 to the k. So Richard, you have a question?
Yeah. And it's get bogged down in details, but those are, if you have those two states, then they'll be orthogonal, right? Because if you have a different number of Bell states, I guess you would have them with non-entangled states.
Let's say that you had them with states in the 0-0 state.
Okay.
Then if you have, for example, n pairs of 0-0s and n EPR pairs, then the overlap would be 1 over square root of 2 to the n. So it wouldn't be exactly orthogonal.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay, thanks.
Of course, you could pad with something that is orthogonal to EPR. You could pad with 0-1 states, for example.
Okay.
But even then, local unitaries could make them have a small overlap. And that's kind of what we're interested in. We're interested in saying local unitaries, you can move within these different sectors. And these sectors are almost separated. So if you have something that locally looks like k EPR pairs and something that locally looks like l EPR pairs, entanglement, local unitaries can only do so much to make them close. They'll always, the maximum fidelity you can get goes down exponentially with the difference between k and. So that's that's sort of the reason why we can think of this as an approximate superselection. So this decomposition, each of this, the kth term here is entangled over 2 to the k dimensions. So I can think of this as I've got something entangled over 2 dimensions, over 4 dimensions, over 8, 16, 32 dimensions. This is not always a great approximation of the state, but a slight tweak of it does. So if instead of powers of 2, we have powers of something that's quite close to 1, then all of a sudden this does become a good approximation. This is sort of a pain to write down and to think about. So from now on, I'll just assume things are this form. But think of this as the justification for why we're allowed to do that. So it's not really a superselection rule. And it's not really strictly true that we can always write things in this form. However, for our approximate purposes, we can think of it as a superselection rule, and we can think of things as superpositions of different amounts of entanglement. Robin?
The ket at the bottom there, phi sub blah, 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 as being a maximally entangled state of dimension between 2 to the k and 2 to the k plus 1?
No, thanks for asking. This should be a max. This thing is an integer here. This is 2 to the 1 plus epsilon times k rounded down to the nearest integer. So it's an integer, you know, like 2. Basically, these integers will look like, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 3, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 7, 9, 13. You know, sort of jumping up sort of irregularly. And you can write your thing as a superposition of states of that form. That doesn't answer your question.
I guess what I was getting at is that you didn't define epsilon anywhere else, and so I don't know how small epsilon is.
Oh, right, thanks. So the smaller epsilon is, the better your approximation. So
I think I'll just ask for the technical details offline.
Yeah.
Later. Thanks.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I know why you're confused, because I shouldn't have put this 1 plus here. This should be 2 to the epsilon here. Or you could also think of this as 1 plus epsilon. Okay. So it's, the point is instead of jumping up by powers of 2, you jump up by powers of 1.001, let's say. And so you could have, you know, you don't have these quantization errors. I promise that in any case, this is a technicality. And this way of thinking about it, If you will accept that states can be approximated by things vaguely like this, then you'll have the right idea.
Instead of your superselection sectors having 1 e-bit, 2 e-bits, 3 e-bits, 4 e-bits, the first one has, 1.1 e-bits, and the second one has 1.2 e-bits, and that's so you're fine grading them?
That's exactly. Yeah. That's what I want. But I wrote it wrong. Okay, so what can we do with this sort of approximate superselection rule? So the idea is that we don't have a strictly block diagonal matrix, but we have something that approximately has that form. So if we do think of any transformation where we've used local operations and no more than, let's say, q qubits of communication, then this transformation cannot mix very different amounts of entanglement. So if you have, let's say, 10 qubits of communication, you can't go from 0 e-bits to a million e-bits. And you can't even do that approximately. So if the state space we think of as, 1 e-bit, 2 e-bits, 3 e-bits, 4 e-bits, and so on, if we have a small amount of communication, then we're stuck with things pretty close to the diagonal. We can sort of move within the same amount of entanglement. We can add a little bit or take away a little bit of entanglement. But as we try and move between very different amounts of entanglement, then we have to, then the matrix elements have to decay exponentially. So in an approximate but a pretty strong sense, we get we can say you're restricted to working within one sector. This also says that states which look like superpositions of very different amounts of entanglement should have something interesting going on with them. For one thing, they should be difficult to create, at least with just starting with EPR pairs. And if they're difficult to create, then maybe they can do something that EPR pairs alone can't do. It doesn't say what they can do, I mean, besides create more states like this of this form. But definitely, working with states of this form should be somehow difficult. So that's the implication. Now, I want to justify this super selection picture by arguing back from the resource picture. To connect these two, I'm going to quantize this Danish fairy tale, as Aki Masu said. So the original version of the fairy tale of the princess and the pea is a mysterious woman appears in a storm, knocks on the door of a palace, asks to be let in. They let her stay for the night, and she claims that she's a princess. The queen wants her son to marry well, doesn't really believe her, and so puts this woman in a room with a bed with 20 mattresses. And underneath the bottom mattress is a single pea. And the next morning, she asks how she slept, and the woman says, terribly. I was black and blue from some lumps in the bed. You know, it was really a nightmare. And the prince does what I think any reasonable person would do in the circumstances, says, this is a person I want to spend the rest of my life with, and marries her on the spot. Yeah. So that's the story. Now, the quantum version, we have an even more refined princess, one who can not only detect small classical peas, which is after all pretty easy, but she demands to sleep in a superposition of 20 mattresses and one mattress. And she demands it be the positive superposition. She says if it's anything else, she won't be able to sleep. In particular, people have tried to put her on the negative superposition before, and it's been terrible. So this is really, you know, much more delicate than the normal princess. And the prince is pretty excited about this, because this is the sort of woman he's looking for. You know, he said, believe in the traditional marriage. However, he also knows that it takes a lot of work to put all these mattresses on the bed. You know, wasn't even strong enough to do it himself. He had to use a forklift to stack these 20 heavy mattresses. So the question is, should he marry this princess? Now, if she can distinguish these two states, then of course she could run her quantum algorithm coherently. She doesn't have to do this in a way that decoheres things. She could take the answer and apply a phase to it. So she could, if the system is in, let's say, the plus state, if she sleeps well, she applies a phase of -1. And if she doesn't sleep well, she doesn't apply any phase at all. So she could do this without causing any other disturbance. For example, she could compute. She could make the measurement, perhaps creating all sorts of garbage along the way, apply a phase to the answer to the measurement, and then uncompute all of the garbage. However, the prince knew quantum mechanics. He would know that applying a sigma z operator in this basis of the plus minus basis is equivalent to applying a sigma x operator in the many mattress, no mattress basis, which means that being able to distinguish the two is as powerful as being able to add all those mattresses to the bed. And so the so-called princess is actually not such a delicate flower. So it's a cautionary tale about trusting quantum princesses.
no P and P plus with the different phases of PERT?
Right. Well, then all you know is that he has a print that's capable of putting a P under that. So that might be. I guess if he wants to marry someone like his mother, that's okay. Okay, so the relevance to entanglement is it's not just as a way of waking people up so they hear more things about entanglement. It's also that going from, okay, so here I'm doing sort of what I said I would before, Richard, which is I'm to dispense with the labels. I just have a separate product state, which is just totally orthogonal to the EPR terms. If you have this product state, n 0 1s, and you want to convert it to n EPR pairs, we know from our well-understood resource picture that there's no way of doing this without transmitting n qubits. So in this picture, we can think of this product state as being one matrix, and this state that has a lot of entanglement as being the one with a lot of matrices. And so the point is that distinguishing the plus or minus superposition here should also be difficult. So these exotic entangled states should be difficult to even tell when they're in your possession. In particular, they should require at least n over 2 qubits in order to distinguish these. And the reason is basically the story I just told, which is that if you can distinguish these two, you can measure them at basis, then you can also apply a sigma z in that basis, which would be able to create a large amount of entanglement. So if you have two states which are hard to move between, then distinguishing superpositions of them, different phase and superpositions, should also be difficult to do. Which means that if you have a small amount of communication, let's say far too little communication to be able to distinguish these, then you can't tell if you have a superposition of these or a mixture of them. It really looks like you have the superposition is right. It really looks like a sort of super selection constraint where you you can't do anything meaningful with this. With this coherence between the two segments. And this bound, I should mention, is nice because it works even if you're given unlimited EPR pairs. So, and the reason is pretty simple. We just apply the same argument to the states where, in both cases, you have many EPR pairs. And because doing this, because distinguishing these will take you from some large number of EPR pairs to even more EPR pairs, and we know that that too requires quantum communication, then this means that that even with unlimited EPR pairs, it still is no easier to distinguish these two things. Okay, so it's hard to distinguish these states. It's hard to create them. I should give you so this sort of operational picture. It sounds a little bit like there's a series of different examples, but there's a fairly general rule here, a good way to characterize everything, which is something called entanglement spread. The way it works is you have a state psi where the strict coefficients lambda I. Suppose that there are non-zero Schmidt coefficients, and we'll order them. So lambda 1 is the biggest one, lambda r is the smallest one. Then you can quantify how much communication a general state requires to create from EPR pairs. And the amount of communication is precisely log of r times lambda 1 over 2. This quantity is called the entanglement spread of psi. It may seem a little bit mysterious, but it's not that bad, as I'll show you in a second. For example, suppose that you have a maximally entangled state. In that case, each one of these coefficients is 1 over r, and r times lambda 1 is simply 1, and the spread of a maximally entangled state is 0. Whereas for states where you have one very large Schmidt coefficient and then many, many very small ones, this quantity will be much larger and require a lot of communication in order to create. And the proof that you need this much communication to create this state was given by Hayden and Winter several years ago. And it's very simple. It's simply that every qubit that you transmit change each of these quantities by at most a factor of 2. So if you have a state with Schmidt rank 7 and you transmit 1 qubit, the most it can go to afterwards is 14. Each thing can at most split into each unentangled piece can split into at most a Schmidt rank 2 state. And similarly, lambda 1, the largest eigenvalue, can at most either double or be cut in half. And so when you start, r times lambda 1 is 1, and then each qubit can change it by at most multiply it by 4, divide it by 4 at most. You can't change more than that in either direction. Yes?
What if instead of trying to prepare the state perfectly, you only want to get high fidelity?
So the next bullet point addresses this. Approximate versions exist. They are less pretty to write down. But the intuition is basically, suppose you're content with epsilon fidelity. Then you can always modify this state by changing it by order epsilon by throwing away various parts of it in an effort to bring down r and lambda 1. For example, to bring down r, you should throw away the smallest things up to weight epsilon. And to bring down lambda 1, you should throw away the largest things up to weight epsilon. And so basically, that's the answer. So you do that, and that's how much communication it takes. This is also achievable. This is a recent work by me and Patrick, which turns out to be a very, very short argument. You can achieve this plus a small correction term. So this is really characterized how much communication it takes to create. And now the reason I like to think why entanglement spread, I think, is a nice way to think about this, is going back to this picture of a state as a superposition of different amounts of entanglement, we can think of the state as being described by a distribution of entanglement. This piece of K is some distribution over the amount of entanglement. And if we assume that each of these coefficients, I get sort of vague here, but bear with me, assume that each of these coefficients is reasonably large. You know, you don't have some very, very small ones. That might be that an approximate version we wouldn't care about, then the largest eigenvalue will be determined by the smallest value of k. So there'll be some contribution from piece of k, but basically to know the largest eigenvalue, you just want to look at the sort of least entangled part of the sector. Whereas to look to find the rank r, you want to find the most entangled part of the state. So r is going to be dominated by the largest value of k for which there is any support, and lambda 1 will be dominated by the smallest value of k for which there is any support. And so the spread of a state is approximately just the diameter of the support of this distribution p. So diameter just means the distance between the farthest two away points of the distribution. And then approximate versions, you can see, is just, well, how much can you shrink that width of the distribution by chopping off the tails? And so now we can go back to this this matrix state. You can see now that it was chosen to have r times lambda 1 almost as large as possible. So it's got some support with 0 bits of entanglement and some support with n bits of entanglement. And so the spread is roughly n, or n minus 1, but on the order of n. So creating the state requires roughly n over 2 qubits of communication. So this is entanglement spread. So it doesn't characterize everything that goes down the middle, but it's just sort of the two endpoints. OK, so fine, we have this picture of entanglement as something constrained by superselection, not as a resource. But if we care about this thing from an operational point of view, you know, then why should we care about this? What's the relation to some actual task that we want to do with communication or manipulating quantum information. So the reason these sort of facts have been known for a while, for example, this paper of Hayden and Vinter was from 2002. The reason people, I think, ignore this for a long time is that when you're communicating something on the order of n, then the contribution from spread has often been sublinear, say, on the order of square root of n. So a key example of this is the problem of entanglement dilution. So suppose you want to prepare many copies of a state psi from EPR pairs. This is part of part of the resource picture of entanglement, is that this is possible. And the amount of communication you need to do this turns out to be on the order of square root of n. And this is just because you have psi has some distribution of Schmidt values. N copies have a distribution that's approximately Gaussian. And the width of the Gaussian is square root of n times some constant that depends on psi. So if you chop off the tails of this Gaussian, then you get a very good approximation of psi tensor n. And this entanglement spread is only on the order of square root of n. So if your effort otherwise is linear in n, then square root of n doesn't really matter. However, once you start looking, once you realize what spread is and can sort of handle it more directly, then it's possible to see that it shows up in settings where that there are settings where it does lead to a linear contribution to the costs. In other words, the cost of dealing with spread is comparable or even greater than the cost of dealing with all other parts of the communication protocol. So one example, which has been untold number of years in the making, is the problem of simulating a noisy channel. So if you have a channel N, so the classical channel now, which takes input from Alice and adds some noise to it and gives it to Bob, then Shannon's noisy coding theorem, more precisely, says that if you give this channel input distribution P, then you can code with it at this rate, a rate called the mutual information between Alice's input and Bob's output. So what this means is, let's say a channel is rate 2/3, then 3,000 copies of the channel can give you maybe not quite 2,000, but 1,990 copies of a noiseless channel, something that sends bits perfectly, up to some overall, there's a vanishing probability of error. So this is Shannon's theorem, and the reverse Shannon theorem says that we can do the opposite simulation, that we can simulate the channel on this input using asymptotically the same rate of communication as well as some additional shared randomness cost. The shared randomness cost turned out to be the same amount that you could have extracted if this were a feedback channel. In other words, if Alice got a copy of Bob's output. So it's really a perfectly reversible simulation, at least asymptotically. So that's on a particular input. On a general input, then we have the capacity of a channel you have to maximize over all possible input distributions. This is also the cost of the simulation, because you can just it's only a very small amount of information to say what the distribution is of the input. And similarly, the randomness cost is simply the maximum over all possible input distributions. And what this gives us is that, in fact, there's an equality between using this many noisy channels and this many noiseless channels, at least asymptotically, and assuming that shared randomness is a free resource. Okay, so this is nice because it lets us say that any channel is interconvertible with any other channel, just described by a single parameter, which is its capacity. Rob?
Do you mean on an unknown IID input that's not necessarily P? I'm just curious what you mean.
I mean an input where I haven't made an assumption about it being IID or any assumption about its distribution.
So no assumptions at all.
Then. Right. For sure. I want a simulation that whatever input you put in, it works. Whereas this thing says that it works on average if you draw according to this distribution.
Right.
So this works on any input in the worst case. But it's basically
reduces to the IID case because you just look at the input and it has, let's say, 17 ones and 10 zeros. And then you say, okay, well, that it's like something drawn from that distribution, which is 1, 17 out of 27 at the time. And saying the number 17 takes a very small amount of communication. You know, that's like log n bits. So you can just transmit that basically for free and then reduce to this case.
Whatever the empirical distribution of the inputs ends up being,
yeah.
If that is, you know, p prime, which is not the worst case p, do you get to save your unused randomness and capacity?
Yes, you do. So yeah, it could be even better, but in worst case, it's okay. So what about the quantum case? So I think this fact is sort of less well known than it should be. That we talk about how ugly the classical capacity of a channel is, but if you have three EPR pairs, the capacity is actually very nice to work with. It's like Jeb Bush, sort of the one that no one hears about, even though he's the responsible, well-behaved one. So this capacity is it's additive, for example. It looks just like the classical capacity. You know, it's a mutual information. Okay, it's divided by 2 because it's qubits instead of qubits, but this is sort of a small detail. And we have a reverse Shannon theorem for this case as well. So if you have shared entanglement, you can code at this rate. And if you have shared entanglement and some known distribution of your input row, and you're simulating on many copies of row, then you can simulate the channel at the same rate that the channel can communicate at. So this is great. This means that you can that any channel given 3 EPR pairs can be simulated at a rate equal to its capacity. Unfortunately, with this caveat, that it only works on a known IID input. So we'd like to do the same thing that we did classically. Say, well, just look at the input and yes, it's true that you can't exactly determine rho without causing damage to the state, but you can approximately determine rho without causing damage, and this part isn't that big of a difficulty. But we can't just combine the protocols. So we'd like to say, look, just take the maximum rate at which you need to send communication and the maximum amount of entanglement that you need for any possible input. Whatever the maximum is, you know, allocate that many resources, and then we should be able to do the simulation on any input. And it's true that we can do it on any tensor power input, but we can't do it on fully general. So suppose the input of the channel is a mixture of 2 different tensor power inputs. And let's say that each of these states, rho and sigma, require the same amount of communication, but different amounts of entanglement. Then the protocol needs to consume entanglement, essentially consume a superposition of different amounts of entanglement. Or rather, one branch of the superposition needs to consume 100 EPR pairs, and the other branch needs to consume 50 EPR pairs. And unfortunately, you can't just allocate 100 EPR pairs to that problem, because the environment will know if you've discarded 50 EPR pairs. You can't just sweep that under the rug. If you try and discard them, then it'll break the superposition between those 2 branches. So you need to create a large amount of entanglement spread, an amount that scales with n, the number of uses of the channel. So this requires, you have to change the asymptotic rate of communication. So unfortunately, if you only have 3 EPR pairs, and then, let's say, classical or quantum communication, then you unfortunately cannot simulate a channel at the same rate that it can communicate, because you have to not only match the capacity of the channel, but there's this additional cost of creating entanglement spread. Fortunately, there is an answer to this called embeddling states, which I will describe later. But there is a way of doing it with the correct amount of communication, but the answer is really that you have to move beyond just using EPR pairs.
Sorry for so many questions, but since you have a mixture of rho to the n and sigma to the n, why is it a problem if the environment breaks superposition. It already knows which it is.
Ah, thanks. So yeah, that was sort of a shorthand. When I say that the input is rho tensor n plus sigma tensor n, I mean it sort of in the sense that we talk about we have to compress rho tensor n. We're talking about Schumacher compression. Really, I mean, what you put into the channel looks like this, but it could be entangled with a reference system. And you have to preserve the entanglement with the reference system. Or equivalently, this could be an ensemble of pure states. Such that the average density matrix of this ensemble looks like this, but you really want high fidelity on all the elements of the ensemble. So so it's not like you just have to get fidelity on the matrix. We have to do this sort of stronger tensor. Right. Okay. So the general goal of what we're doing here, it's not what you think. It's a class of operations called local operations and shared entanglement. So these are the operations we can do with local operations and, let's say, an arbitrary shared entangled state, no communication. Of course, maybe we like to broaden that a bit, say, well, maybe we'll allow q qubits of communication. And there are, of course, variants of it. You can just allow local operations, no entanglement at all. You can have local operations and unlimited EPR pairs, and so on with a little bit of quantum communication. Unfortunately, determining membership in this class, even approximately, was shown by Gus Katowski to be NP hard. So this is sort of a sign that it's going to be hard to prove things about this class. It's going to be hard to get elegant characterizations of what it's like. In general, people haven't looked very hard at this sort of thing. I mean, this work is pretty recent, and it's sort of, you know, really taking the first steps towards defining what's going on. But it won't be a total cakewalk. However, there's still a number of things we can say. So some of the key questions in this field that we want to answer are, when are EPR pairs helpful? We know that they're sometimes helpful. So very trivially, if your task is to create a bunch of EPR pairs, then it's helpful to have EPR pairs. This is kind of a dumb example, but it's worth keeping in mind that depending on how you define the problem, they definitely can be very helpful. They also help with superdense coding. So you can at least double your rate of communication in some settings if you have shared entanglement. May not be very much, but in some cases, this is really the most help they can provide. And what about other forms of entanglement? So when can these exotic superpositions of different amounts of EPR pairs, when are these more helpful than EPR pairs? So simulating quantum channels is one example, although I was vague about exactly how. I'll mention more in a minute. So one particular subproblem within the class of Lewes problems overall is communication complexity. Suppose Alice and Bob receive classical inputs and want to compute a classical output, then when can they do this? How much communication do they need? How much does entanglement help? And so on. So I want to mention a few things that we do know about this class of when non-standard entanglement can help. The first example is a pretty old one. And it's something called embeddling states. So there's one thing I haven't proved, but I just want to assert, which is when communication isn't free, EPR pairs are one of the weakest forms of entanglement. And they're one of the weakest because any other form of entanglement can be converted with no communication into EPR pairs. You can think of converting it to this sort of standard form and then just measuring the register k, which tells you how many EPR pairs you have. So that's the weakest form. What's the strongest kind of entanglement? It may be that there's no unique answer. There's just a million incomparable forms of entanglement. And the whole story is a complete mess. But fortunately, in this delightful paper of Wim van Dam and Patrick Hayden, again from 8 years ago, they found this somewhat strange family of states, the entanglement embeddling states, are generically the strongest form of entanglement when you have no communication. So if you have a k-qubit embeddling state, it has the property that any n by n qubit state can be created from the embeddling state without even destroying the original state with no communication at all. So this is sort of a general well from which you can draw any entangled state you like without even disturbing the original state. Of course, this is only possible up to a small error, but the error is as small as possible that's consistent with Fanis's inequality. So it's the error is like the number of qubits you embeddle divided by the size of the original state. So what this means is something which I think has only partially been accepted, but I would argue that free entanglement is often thought of as unlimited EPR pairs, but a sort of more appropriate definition of this is to say you have access to an embeddling state of arbitrary size. And so when we consider Lewis operations, for example, then we don't have to say allow an arbitrary entangled state. We can just say allow an arbitrarily large embeddling state. It makes the whole problem somewhat simpler. So I think I want to skip this part of the talk, even though it's some work I did with Debbie that we were very excited about. Actually, no, I'll do it very quickly. One other quick use of unstandard entanglement is a problem of measuring. Let's say you want to do a P of M. You want to know, is our state in the state alpha, or is it orthogonal to alpha? So alpha, I mean projection onto a pure state alpha. So it turns out that you can, if you have many copies of the state alpha, then you can test to see if a new one is equal to the existing ones approximately. This is like saying that if you have many spins pointing in a direction, you can tell if a new spin is pointing in the same direction. And the way you do this is you have your m minus 1 copies, you have your new unknown state, beta, and you want to know if beta is equal to alpha or orthogonal to it. And if it's equal to it, this entire thing will be symmetric. It'll just be many copies of alpha. If it's orthogonal, it'll have a very small overlap with a symmetric subspace. Not zero, but 1 over m. M is big, it's pretty small. So to do this measurement, it suffices to be able to project onto the symmetric subspace. So this is useful in a distributed setting. If these states are now entangled states, this is a joint measurement they'd like to do. It turns out you can project onto the symmetric subspace using not very much communication, at least if you start with a state where m minus 1 are already identical. And that means that you can do this non-local measurement using a very small amount of communication. As an application, if you have this unitary operator, which is this reflection operator, you can show that simulating it using EPR pairs requires n qubits of communication. But if you have the right entangled state, so the right one of these, you know, many copies of the state alpha, basically, then you can simulate it approximately using a very small amount of communication. So you get a dramatic separation between the cost of this thing using EPR pairs and the cost using general entanglement. You can also show this is a unitary interaction which can entangle a lot, but is very lousy for communication. So we can only communicate sort of order log n bits, but nevertheless can entangle two parties very efficiently. One final application which I was actually very excited about trying to find, and then failed, but at least failed by proving that it was impossible, is to communication complexity. So this is the last application I'll tell you about. So Alice and Bob both get classical strings, and they want to produce a classical output. And let's say it's a single bit, is their classical output. And they'd like to maybe allow a small amount of error. And they want to use as little communication as possible. Certainly with n bits, Alice could just send her whole message to Bob. And we could consider one-way communication or two-way communication either way. So classically, this is well studied. And it's known that shared randomness can indeed help. For example, if you want to tell if two strings are equal, it helps to have some shared randomness. But by very little. There's something called Newman's theorem, which says no matter how much shared randomness you have, you can simulate it using order log n bits of shared randomness. And the proof is a pretty simple kind of sampling argument. Of course, it's natural to ask then, can entanglement help? It's known that if you have EPR pairs, they definitely help a lot. But the only way we know that they help is by turning classical communication into quantum communication. So if you already have, if you're already allowed quantum communication, it's unknown whether EPR pairs offer much help. The only example we know is the equality function. They can save a factor of 2. But for all we know, they could save much more. So we can also ask, can embeddling states or other forms of exotic entangled states save even more communication? And the answer to this turns out to be no. So I claim that general entanglement is not much better than EPR pairs. And the proof is very simple once you adopt this framework. If you have a protocol P, your communication protocol, that uses only q qubits of communication, your starting state is psi. What you're interested in is the probability of accepting your inputs minus the probability of rejecting it. And you can write it in this form. You start with psi, you apply your protocol, you measure one qubit at the end. So you have sigma z can measure the probability of accepting minus the probability of rejecting, tensor, identity, and everything else. And then you sandwich this basically between p sigma. So you can rewrite this as the trace of projection onto psi times something that looks like a protocol that exchanges 2q qubits of communication. And so this is a protocol that uses a limited amount of communication. So we can write it so it has this form. We have, you know, the diagonal can be as close to 1 as you like, but as we move away from the diagonal, things decay exponentially. And on the right, we've got basically, this is just the projection to psi. We have down the diagonal, we have p1, p2, p3, and then we have these off-diagonal terms corresponding to coherence between different amounts of entanglement. And the point is, this probability can't really see what's happening way off the diagonal. So we could just set those to 0, and nobody would notice. And this means we can replace the state psi with a mixture of states that are each have small amount of spread and only incur a small amount of error. And so in particular, the amount of spread that these have is enough that you can simulate it with only a small amount of additional communication. So non-standard entangled states cannot improve communication complexity of functions, at least, by very much. For unitaries, they can have a huge impact. But for this sort of more traditional computing and joint function, not so much. Finally, I'll mention a few open questions, of which there are many. Of course, we'd like to know, in general, when does entanglement spread help and when are EPR pairs good enough? There are many different models. I mean, I've just shown a few where entanglement spread is better than EPR pairs. I've said that the spread picture is sort of different from the resource picture. But there are ways of applying the resource sort of model back to spread. For example, when can we interconvert between different sources of spread? You know, various numbers of partially entangled states, for example. Everything I've talked about has been for pure states, but there are a number of interesting questions for mixed states. The sort of theme, what we get for spread, is that you have to invest communication to create it. But in the end, you're left with something that is just an entangled state that doesn't carry and be able to communicate itself. So there are many similar times, there are many examples where this happens with mixed states as well. We'd like to better characterize analogs of spread in that case. And finally, I alluded to this question before. In communication complexity, we don't even know if EPR pairs help. So we know that general entangled states are no better than EPR pairs, but we don't even know if EPR pairs can help. We know that they save at least a factor of 2, and at most an exponential factor. And between that, we really know nothing. The only hope is that, or my hope, is that these techniques of spread and dividing things into different sectors can argue that having a lot of entanglement isn't actually all that helpful.
But we'll see how it affects. And that's all. Thanks for your attention.
It's time for the questions.